everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of the Read Right to Left podcast. I am G, joined by my always wonderful co-host, Ray, from Whimsical Pictures.
Hi, guys.
And this month, we've had a bit of a shuffle with the schedule once again, but this month, we are going to be talking about the classic 70s sci-fi series, To Terra, or Toward the Terra. It goes by a couple different names.
Yeah.
So, which isn't confusing whatsoever. Which is I believe it's a 5-volume series in Japan. It was released in English by Vertical in 3 volumes many a moon ago, and is now currently available digitally through what used to be Manga Planet, now is just that Futakiya Manga Planet
weird
amalgamation.
Eldritchian horror.
Yes, yeah. So you still can read it legally in its entirety, although it just in a digital sense. This series has also had a couple anime adaptations, a 1980 film released by Toei, and a 2007 series from Bandai. Well, it was released by Bandai in the US. I don't know if they're the ones who actually produce it. Doesn't matter.
But whatever.
But both whatever. Both the film and the television anime have also previously been released in English in the United States, at least. Although I do think both are quite out of print at this point. Although in saying that, I don't think this was ever a smash hit success, so you can probably find the releases for fairly decent prices if you want to hunt them down.
Yeah. You can find them, it's just they're books that, I mean, they're early Vertical, it's a pain in the butt to find them, so.
Yeah, yeah. So, Ray, would you do the honors as to summarizing what To Terra, Terra A, is actually about?
Yes. You have to say it right, it's To Terra, ellipsis.
Yeah, it has an ellipsis at the end, so.
Okay, so background on the author and the series. We wax poetic about the Year 24 group all the time on this podcast. Regular viewers will know that we are obsessed, and I in particular am obsessed. Usually, though, we are talking about Moto Hagio, who is the Year 24 creator who has the most work out in English. So this time we are taking the opportunity to talk about, easily the second most well-known, at least in English, of the Year 24 members. In Japan, it's a bit different, but... especially if you consider, like, Ikeda Ryoko or people like that to be members. But anyway, Keiko Takemiya is who we're talking about today. And she is a very prominent member of the Year 24 group, most well-known for this series and her magnum opus, the 17-volume Kaze Toki no Uta, which is... one of the first shoujo manga to feature, a sex scene on the page. And I think the first to feature a same-sex sex scene. That is sort of proto-BL in the same vein as The Heart of Thomas. It is The Heart of Thomas's, slutty sister. slutty sister. this series, though, To Terra, is a 5-volume sci-fi space opera in the classic 1970s tradition. And it is actually, a lot of people consider it to be like shoujo or mistake it for shoujo, but it did originally run in Gekkan Manga Shonen, which makes it a shonen manga. For whatever it's worth. A lot of the Year 24 members very much were genre hoppers, would go to various different magazines and work in various different demographics throughout their careers. So yeah, now about the series itself. Oh, this was published 1978 to 1980 originally. But the series To Terra, with Terra here meaning Earth, it's written in the kanji in Japanese. First, this thing spans decades, but in five short volumes, or three longer volumes, if you have the vertical books. But we start out with a 14-year-old named Jomi Marcus Sheen. This book is full of just wonderful sci-fi anime names. of a 14-year-old named Jomi Marcus Sheen in the year 3XXX, after the Earth has been so horrendously polluted that humans have found that they have no choice but to leave it. We're doing the Wall-E thing. And have since decided that, you know, the reason that Earth was so ruined is because of the folly of man. And so they've created these great, vast computer networks that basically make all of humanity's decisions for them. And part of that, so the idea is to create such a rigidly controlled society that they can never fuck up the planet the way that they did before. And part of that system involves that adults and children are separated from one another, except for, I guess, the adults whose, like, occupation that, of course, is chosen to them by the computer, for them by the computer, is as, like, a nurturer or foster parent. Children are all born in test tubes in this year 3XXX, and then they are passed on to the foster parents who will raise them on one of, like, a handful of educational artificial planets. So we start on one of those called Ataraxia, which is the educational planet that Jomi Marcus Sheen is raised on. And he, it's his birthday. He's just turned 14. And when the kids in this dystopian future turn 14, it is time for them to become adults, separate from their educational planet and their parents forever, and go to Terra, and be given an occupation there, and live out their adult lives, doing everything the computers tell them to do. And nothing else.
Nothing else. Don't even attempt to try to think for yourself, because it's just, you're gonna fuck it up. Just don't. It's not gonna happen. You're gonna fuck it up,
and you're gonna become a psychic. But we'll get there. So, when the kids turn 14, on the day they turn 14, they go through a maturity check, which is, like, they go before the computer system, and the computer system determines whether they're ready to become an adult or not, and erases all of their memories of the planet that they grew up on.
I.e. the world's worst vibe check. You just don't want to fail that one.
And, you see, this maturity check, it turns out, has some unfortunate side effects for an alarmingly large chunk of the population. this interaction with the computer system has led to the creation of an offshoot of the human race called the Mew. And I'm sure you've guessed it, they're psychics. They're all psychics. and they're psychic kids because they age super slowly. When Mew children go through the maturity check, it activates their, like, dormant ESP powers. And if the computer has its way, they just get, like, murdered on the spot or carted off to be lab rats. But the Mew that do exist, the ones who have managed to get away, to run away, are always sort of looking for others of their kind to rescue. They are in a big space colony floating around in space. Basically, it's a spaceship. Jomi goes for his maturity check, but he is ill at ease because he keeps having these strange dreams of a mysterious boy named Soldier Blue, who tells him, you know, that essentially that he's Mew and that he needs to go to Terra. And so he has no idea what this means, but he's told people about it, which means that the government's at his back. we have this sort of clash as he goes through his maturity check that, like, ends up awakening his ESP powers, and he ends up escaping with the Mew and ends up on their ship. Where he learns from Soldier Blue and this blind oracle they have named Physis, who, looking at the katakana, her name is actually supposed to be pronounced Physis, but I'm not doing that. so Physis and Soldier Blue, they tell him that he's supposed to be the new leader of the Mew because he is both human and Mew. The Mew all have various, like, physical abnormalities, physical difficulties, like Physis, who is blind. And they're also very sort of temperamental compared to the humans. And, like, they're so easily swayed by their emotions that it, like, gets in their way on the battlefield. But Jomi doesn't have these issues. He is a strapping young boy. and he's also an incredibly powerful psychic. So that means he's destined to lead the Mew toward their ultimate goal, which is to return to Terra, a place that has been denied them. And seek to coexist with humanity as one of humanity's offshoots. Meanwhile, the other sort of major leg of the story comes back with the humans. We have this guy named Keith, which is just the most boring name. Keith Anyan. Who he is, like, the perfect honors student. He's just, you know, he's gotten through his maturity check, so he's in basically their equivalent to high school, training for 2 years before he goes off to do whatever job the computer gives him. But the computer has a special job for him. He's going to be the leader of humanity. He doesn't know that yet, but that's what he's being trained for. And he is, yeah, perfect honor student. He's really good at just, like, bottling up those emotions. He's very deadpan. But he's starting to harbor doubts about the system, which is a very dangerous thing to do. He's starting to question things. But when he actually goes before the mother computer, she tells him that that's just as well. It's a sign that he is developing exactly as planned. And eventually what we learn is that he has been artificially created, even more artificially than all the other humans, who at least, like, have a human mother and father who has provided. Well, it's... Anyway, it doesn't matter. They're all humans who have, like, had, you know, their components sort of donated and then have been grown in a test tube. But Keith, half of his DNA is artificially created by the mother computer itself. So he is essentially an android, although he is flesh and blood. And the computer has created him specifically to carry out its own will, as the leader of humanity. And so we have these two diametrically opposed forces, bound to clash eventually, and things continue from there.
Pretty much. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Spiral wildly out of control.
Yes, yeah. This is certainly... This series is sort of quintessential 70s sci-fi, right? Yeah. There's a lot of weird bullshit happening. The 70s and 80s were just absolutely enamored with psychics slash, you know, ESP. It's really interesting to see a lot of these various elements kind of come together in this series. And I think it, in saying that, there's a universality of place and, you know, these questions that sci-fi always brings up as to, like, what does it mean to be human, and, like, humanity's relationship with our home planet, with Earth.
With Earth and with technology.
Yes. And so, although this is, at this point, a 40-year-old series, it really does have a lot of ideas that persist within current era sci-fi. It feels quite modern in how, I mean, just in those conversations, they mm-hmm. are, or not modern, it feels very timeless.
Yeah.
Yes. With those ideas and the way that Takamiya kind of approaches the series in her way. It's just fun to read about. I'm not going to say this is the easiest series to parse through.
It's very wordy. But
at the same time, yes, yeah. It's quite dense. And there's a lot of, I guess, lore. A lot of
techno-babble.
Yeah, told to us. In the way that, like, a lot of sci-fi does anyway, inherently, it's quite of the genre. But if you do not like long character monologues and long part, like, periods of several pages where characters are just talking to themselves about the meaning of existence and, you know, all of these looking out into the stars, like, truly, what does it mean to be human? Then this is not a series for you. Just up front.
This, but if you eat that shit up,
then boy, oh boy, do we have a series for you. Yeah.
Takemiya, in her way, definitely much less abstract of a creator, even in her sci-fi, than Hagio, who we talk about a lot. Yes. So, like, it's more straightforward than if you're reading something like Otherworld Barbara or Marginal, which is not in English, but... And... It's still very interior, it's very introspective, but not quite to the extent, I think, that you would typically see from, like, Hagio. And part of that, too, is that this is a shonen magazine that it ran in. But I would say that it's sort of a consistent thing throughout Takemiya's work. She's more of a straightforward, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened kind of creator.
Yes, yeah.
Comparatively speaking. I guess we could just go into that particular question. We don't have, like, a ton of questions, but we'll just use them as a jumping-off point. So, at Paulina Lua says, what is a characteristic about Tutera that to you screams Takemiya? What do you think, G? I think you've read Andromeda stories as well, right?
Yes, although she didn't write that one. No. She only did the art for that. Yeah. As Ray said, there is a, when compared to our most notable year 24 member, at least in English, and I'd argue in Japan as well, there's certainly a approachability that Hagio doesn't really care about. Hagio is very focused on telling her own story, and if you vibe with it, then fantastic. Thanks for coming.
Hagio's
on the journey.
Writing for Hagio. And no one else.
Whereas Takemiya does have a, I guess, better sense of marketability, maybe, or genre staples, which, again, does, as Ray said, does make her series a little bit more approachable, a little bit easier to digest. You're not going to be completely confused, especially if you are used to the kind of trappings of the genre. And I would suspect that a lot of people, especially in the late 70s, there was so much sci-fi around just in media, and had been. Sci-fi has been a mainstay, and was a mainstay throughout the 20th century for a long time, because it was a very exciting time for space exploration and, you know, this postmodern look at humanity and all of these things. So being able to tap into that, I'm sure helped a lot with the approachability of this series. But I do think that Takemiya brings her own sense of like her ideals into humanity's place, I guess, and how people interact and how our relationship with technology, the scary technology that runs our lives, which again is somewhat of a, I mean, it's quite universal, but I do feel that that element feels quite modern, because we
feels very relevant.
We have so much of our lives is now mandated by technology and run by technology, and like all of our entertainment, all of our communications, most people's work, or at least most corporate people's work. It's something that has persisted and stayed even more, become even more relevant.
Especially all the stuff, you know, it very much is like, you know, it may have been the realm of like dystopia in the 70s, but you know, the idea of having your entire worldview so thoroughly shaped by an algorithm or a series of algorithms that you can't even possibly conceive of other points of view anymore is certainly very relevant today. And that's something that I was feeling as I was rereading this series for this episode.
Yeah, for sure. And so it really does make, I would recommend, if you are interested in sci-fi, even if you're not inherently like a classic manga fan, it is worth reading this, because it's just, it is, it may have been dystopic at the moment, at that point. And also another thing that is sadly very still relevant and almost more relevant is this ideological clash between people. The conflict between the Mu or Mu and the rest of humanity, and how one group is just trying to survive. They're just trying to, like, get some acceptance. And then the other, like, the majority population is just like, fuck you, no, we don't, we're just going to actively destroy you.
I think it's really, in particular, it's really, like, chilling how it's, like, they teach all the babies who, you know, are born on these educational planets or whatever, mm-hmm. that because they are test tube babies, that they have no individual mother or individual father, that they are all mm-hmm. Descendants of humanity as a whole. But then yes, there's, like, yeah. this huge chunk of these kids who are just end up being thrown, you know, in front of a firing squad because mm-hmm. they're not human. So.
Yeah.
Even though they are. So, like, that whole, like, the way that propaganda, like, feeds itself into sort of a blindness to what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, exactly. And it's for Takamiya to, so, I don't want to say accurately predict the future, but, like, there's some real understanding of humanity there in a way that's, like, very depressing, but unfortunately very relevant. I also think that, as Ray said, this was a shonen series. It was published in a shonen magazine. But it does still, and like a lot of Year 24 artists, that was not unique to her. But I do think that her language, her visual flair, developed over both shoujo and shonen series is very prominent within the mm-hmm. series. I think the way that she portrays a lot of, like, this, the endless sky of stars, right, of this, mm-hmm. of, you know, the outer space, there's the romance there, but also kind of, but the unease of that, which is why the Mu are, or at least Jomi and Soldier Blue leading the Mu, are looking for Terra, looking for home, and a place to belong. Which changes a little bit when the next generation takes over and the end of this story. It's mm-hmm. yeah. and then again, comparatively, it's just, as I said, a lot more easy to parse versus some of the other sci-fi, that classic sci-fi from the Year 24 group that we have seen in the past, because again, Hagio is not, she's not writing for anyone else except for herself.
And we love her for it.
Mm-hmm.
Scribbling away in her cottage in the countryside.
It's not a criticism, it is merely
ignoring every email Takemiya sends her.
Well, what about yourself, Ray?
Yeah. Well, with the art, again, just to expand on it a little bit, I really love, yeah, you mentioned, like, the way that she depicts, like, these vast expanses of stars, being very beautiful and very evocative, but I really like that, not just that, but that in contrast to these, like, towering, like, layered mazes, labyrinths of computer networking, that we see under the Terran Earth and on the educational planets. I think that she develops that contrast very effectively, as well as, like, sort of the equal emptiness that they both have. And it's just very beautiful. Like, there's a lot of spaceships and stuff in this, and they're all incredibly beautifully drawn and rendered. She's, yeah, got a long list of assistants listed in the back of the last volume. So I don't know if that's her specifically or some very talented assistants, but regardless, incredible work, incredible machine drawing. And also just, when we're talking about the Year 24 group, particularly if you're going into this as, like, a shonen manga reader, or knowing that it's a shonen manga, just the manipulation of panel layouts to convey the interiority of the characters, and in particular, the way that that's employed most often in this series is, of course, we've got all these psychics running around. So, I mean, a lot of other series would just have, you know, somebody with their eyes glowing and, like, a beam shooting out of their head or something, but... Takemiya, I think that the way that she portrays the psychological assaults of the Mew, or the way that they share their consciousnesses with each other, or the way that they sort of spread their consciousness throughout space, searching for things and people... she has a lot of really beautiful and interesting ways of portraying that that never get boring to look at. So it's one of my favorite things about the series, to be honest. Because, I don't know, there's something in me that's just, like, allergic to the, like, glowing eyes beam shooting from head thing. So I'm just like, man, that's so cheesy. But even though it's, like, a cheesy story that we're dealing with here, it's like, it the art doesn't make it feel cheesy, right?
Yeah,
it's very beautifully drawn.
There's a grace to it that feels more natural. Like, I don't know, that's not quite the right word, but feels more inherent to how we perceive the world versus just like, ooh, glowy eyes. That's a bit creepy.
Like, how we think and how we connect to other people. I feel like there's... She's capturing some of that in how she portrays sort of these psychic connections, which ends up being very thematically relevant to this idea of the Mew being like, you know, the true offshoot of humanity or whatever. Yeah, those computers, they're just getting in people's ways. Everybody could be fucking telekinetic by now. Speaking of telekinesis, the other Keiko Takemiya trademark here is a little bit more not great. And that is that there is a character type in her work, definitely exemplified by Kaze Tokino Uta's very famous protagonist, Gilbert, but also present here, which is distressingly sexy child.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Sexy, weirdly seductive, prepubescent boy is a type in her work. She has very much said some uncomfy things about boys. And her depiction of them. And, yep. It's here too. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Like, there's not much to, like, elaborate on there. It's not good, and it's uncomfy. it's very much, like, a Year 24 staple to have these sort of, like, younger male characters who are depicted very androgynously, very beautifully, with these very, like, lithe and slender forms. But Takemiya, and the way she does it is a little sketch.
Concerning. and by that I mean very concerning.
It's very concerning. Very, very concerning. So, yep, just wanted to throw that out there. That definitely screams Takemiya to me. Tony.
Which is also, like, I don't know, she had so much, like, enthusiasm for her weird sci-fi names at the beginning, and then she ends up with Keith and Tony at the end, and it's just such a downgrade.
Okay, so his name is Tony, but, like, in the Japanese, it is spelled so weird. This isn't, like, weird romanization. This is, the katakana is weird as shit. It's like toe with a small O and then knee with a small E. It's weird. It's, like, I don't even know how I'm supposed to pronounce that. I guess it's just Tony, but, like, we get it. He's a special snowflake.
This is what happens when you're the first, like, live human birth in 1,000 years, right? You get the weird fucked up name, especially when you're from
and then it's the, like, it's not even like a cool fucked up sci-fi name. It's like it's spelled weird, but then the pronunciation is just Tony. No wonder he's got issues.
Sigh. Yeah. I mean, and he has some major issues, because I alluded to it, but at the end of the series, spoilers for a 40-year-old series, he ends up becoming the new leader of the Mew and decides, actually, we don't want to be, you know, we don't want to find Earth. No one will ever accept us. We're just going to go off into space and find our own planet and not deal with any of this bullshit. Which, like,
fuck
enough,
all of y'all.
Fuck all of y'all. You guys are horrible. We're just trying to exist. Which, again, fair enough. But, like, also, man, you just reneged on, like, at least 2 generations of your people's struggles. To just be like, nah, I'm not dealing with this bullshit. You're, like, 10 years old, dude.
Yeah.
I know you look 24, but you're a baby.
He's 10.
You got no idea.
They're like, yes, he can lead us.
Which is just like I don't know. There's a reason these Mew are endangered, and it's not just because of the computers. They're not exactly making the best decisions for themselves.
Well, I mean, they're just so emotional.
I mean, you can be emotional and also make the decision to have your small party being run by a elementary school kid.
They're just like this entire race of drama queens, and they wonder why the humans are like, please leave.
I know. I was about to say, even the humans recognize that you need to be at least 14 to be kind of given some kind of agency towards your life. It's just like, I don't know. I feel like
to
Ken
be
is very,
fair,
very young.
To be fair, he does have the powers of a god.
That makes it worse. That makes
and
it
like,
so much worse.
And like 7 little friends that he just brings around with him.
Because you know that 10-year-olds, groups of 10-year-olds, only make the most rational decisions, the most well-informed, rational, well-thought-out decisions, especially decisions that affect other people, you know?
He does make only the best decisions about his hair, though. He's incredibly luscious locks.
It is. That is an impressive mane for this contextual 10-year-old.
This infant.
Oh, dear.
So, I brought up the, frankly, pedophilia. Got any opinions about ableism in the series?
Yes.
It's very much the, like, the super crip kind of stereotype or cliche, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, there's an element, and we see this a lot in media, even now, which is just, like, shitty, is the idea that, oh, you are disabled in some way, whether that be a physical disability or a neurological disability or whatever, and that therefore you have unlocked a human potential that, you know, normies, us able-bodied people, can't tap into our brain, therefore we have that these people who have disabilities of all sorts are therefore much more in tune with their bodies and have unlocked superpowers of some kind.
Well, and this one literally even goes as far as to be like, you know, this is their natural evolution as people with disabilities. It's like, they literally call it, like, God's blessing to them.
Yeah.
It's, like, the trade-off that, like, you know, sure, you have one arm or whatever, but here you go, you're psychic. And it's like, okay, but real people aren't psychic, so what are we saying about real people with disabilities, actually?
It's, as said, it's not inherent, like, this is not unique to manga, it's not unique to this series. I mean, fucking Marvel Daredevil is this bullshit, right? But there's the variety, because it's, like, all sorts of disabilities. Even as, prior to this recording, Ray, you mentioned that Jomi's kind of personality deficiency was sort of the era look at or misconception of autism. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, so you're grouping people with autism with, like, people who are blind, with people who have, like, I don't know, weak lungs. Like, these are just so much different. Like, everything is different. And so, not that it would be better, right? Like, I'm not saying that this is a better decision, because this is just a shitty trope that's existed in media for a very long time. And even more so, I really dislike the idea of, like, oh, you're autistic, therefore you have the superpower of, you know, just being brilliant. And you're like, that's okay, that's not how autism works, but alright.
Well, also, and the fact that, like, Jomi is positioned as, like, you are the natural born leader of our race.
You are the hope for our people.
Because you don't have a disability. You are, they're like, you are the perfect Mew, because you're able-bodied. Like, you're psychic, but you're also able-bodied. I do want to clarify, there is, like, this offhand, what we're talking about here is there's an offhand line, where, let me find it, sorry. He has sort of fallen into a psychic coma, and, like, the doctor is, like, it's a kind of autism, and it just comes out of left field a little bit. I don't think... personally, that the series is insinuating that he has autism. He's certainly a character you could read it into, but in this case, I was just talking about how, like, there's this misconception that is sort of outdated now, but certainly still present in Japan, because linguistically, autism is called jiheisho, which literally means closing off of the mind, closing off of the self syndrome. So a lot of people have this image of autism in Japan of children in particular, like, you know, shutting themselves off to the outside world or shutting off, having part of their brain, like, shut off inside of them. But in this case, I think it's just sort of the doctor's like, we don't know what's wrong with him. It's some sort of weird coma. And that's sort of the language that it is expressed with. I don't personally think that the idea is that he has autism. I think the idea is that he's perfect, right? He's, and by perfect, I mean able-bodied and able-minded, which is...
It's also, like, I think the reason that that language is used is because it's like, that's how he made it to this point without being discovered, right? Like, it was his perfect body protecting him, his psychic ability, so that, you know, he'd get, reach 14, and when he was, I guess, old enough or smart enough or whatever... to then be scooped up by the Mew. Man.
But then what the hell happened to Maka?
I don't know.
How did he not get caught? Always just like he would snap in half if you blew on him too hard. He's like little waif who's always like, you know, got lung problems and shit. But he's like, honestly, an adult. He's like 30 or something.
I don't know how any of these Mew have, like, survived. Aside from Soldier Blue, because, like, obviously. And Physis. The rest of them, I feel like they can't do anything. If they do one single thing, they end up hospitalized. And you're like, this is... how are you running a revolution? And I don't mean that in, like, because obviously in real life, I don't think people with disabilities can't run a revolution. But, like, holy shit. Guys, you need to be a bit smarter on, like, how you approach this thing.
Yeah. Because it's what you're just, doing... it's the decision-making skills are a little... I mean, I guess this is why they needed a great leader or whatever. There, but it's okay. We only end up getting to know like 3 Mew, so the rest of them are just there. About,
yeah, they just exist as like these are. Look at the peaceful people we are trying to protect. All they want is to return to Earth, and you're like, okay, well, okay.
So from at Mech Anime Review. How do you find this approach of what it means to be human different from other series that tell a similar story? Is there a vision slash approach that makes it feel special and or stand out? And they also point out, I know the early 80s was a time period where there were a ton of psychics in sci-fi. Yes. We address that, but yeah. So what it means to be human? Well... to talk about that, we have to establish what the series is saying. It means to be human. It's a very naturalist approach, I feel like. Not in terms of, like, nudism, but like the other kind of naturalism.
It was
okay, but Tony though, butt naked right. way too often.
So much so. I'm like, your hair can only protect you so much, sir. This is
child, not infant.
Yeah, well, yeah, kid. Exactly, kid. Kid,
small baby, naked.
I don't know what is. Where are your parents?
He's running around naked, just like he's just floating there. Like, draw me like one of your French girls, and I'm like, you are three.
You are so young, and you're calling Jomi Grandpa, and it just feels weird. It just
feels weird, man.
It's so weird.
Yana Toboso vibes, to be honest. Anyway, so yeah, it's very like, you know. Humans are a part of nature, and it is turning away from nature that has turned us away from our humanity. That's like the core of what it comes down to, is mm-hmm. this idea that, you know, by giving ourselves over to machines, we have given up on what makes us living beings. And with that, we also have, you know, this idea that our free will, our ability to make our own decisions for our lives, to deviate from the script, as it were, because that's sort of the grandmother computer's, like, final last stand, where she has, like, this breakdown. Because that they're like, you know, don't you realize that it's just giving you pre-programmed responses? We see that it is just sort of repeating the same things over and over again, because it's just, you know, an algorithm that has had things put into it. So it's spitting out what's been putting in. Just like ChatGPT. But that, too, also connects to the idea that, you know, if we give ourselves over to the machines we've created too much, then we are deviating from nature, which is free, which is disorganized, which is, like, we can, you know, take in our surroundings and we can deviate from what's been done before. We can change. And we can innovate, whereas the machines can't. So it's, you know, it's tread ground, right? It's well tread ground.
Yeah.
But not for no reason, I think.
Well, what I was wanting to mention, and it goes back to this element of kind of being even more relevant today than it was at the time. The scary idea that this was dystopia in the 70s and now is just kind of reality, is like, I don't know about you, right? And I don't know how it ends up in my YouTube recommendations, but I get so many, like, over the last 10 years, even the last 5 years, and currently there's this rise of, like, hustle culture and... You know, with the rise of the gig economy, everyone needs to have a side job, and, you know, this idea of retiring early and all of these things. And then kind of in a counter backlash to that, people and content creators making content about, like, switching off, right? And reconnecting with the self and, you know, whether it be... yoga or like scheduling rescheduling your brain and not using your phone after 6 p.m. and minimalizing your life, right? Becoming a minimalist or becoming a whatever it may be. And it feels like that element of like, oh yes, you know, we as people have become so caught up in this era of algorithms and TikTok and Facebook and Twitter is crashing and burning, but like all of these things are running our lives, and ChatGPT and the AI is like taking over the art community, and you know, the rise of robo police and all of this unease, just especially in the US, but it's not just the US, with various human rights being taken away, and politics is just an absolute at even farther opposite ends than they've ever been. There's such a skirmish between the political divide, like politics and people, like the general public, and it's just been, there's so much unrest, and we are constantly being fed anger and hatred and upset. We are so connected to every problem in this world immediately because of social media, because of the 24-hour news cycle, because of what, and it's hard. It's really hard to switch off from that. We are still in a pandemic. Technically, nobody seems to give a shit. There's so much, just misinformation around all of that. Mm-hmm. That, frankly, humanity, people are not, we are not adapted to take on all of that information 24 mm-hmm. hours of the day. And especially considering, again, we're in a pandemic, a lot of places were in lockdown for a very long time. All we had to access that outside world was those avenues of content, whether it be fucking Facebook, QAnon misinformation, whether it be just the rage clickbait of Twitter, that like you can understand why people are like, I just don't want to even interact with people anymore. All of that is to say that like I can, this is yet again why this manga has this, I think this element of like, we as people need to there's a reconnection to the outside world and like our communities and all of the good things in life that you get, you lose and you forget when you are stuck doom scrolling. Rereading this series for the podcast, I was like, I can, with this consideration of like these people, this the race of people, the Mew, who are ostensibly depicted as disabled, who have been continually rejected by modern culture and humanity as a whole, like you can understand why they just wanna go and return to that nostalgia of the before times, right? Which again mm-hmm. is very prominent within all political rhetoric, of like, oh, you know, the nostalgia of yesteryear. And then conversely, at the end, when Tony's like, we are just not even going to deal with these humans. We are just going to go into nowhere. You will never find us. It's kind of the equivalent of those people who are like, I'm going off the grid. I'm just going to live in the woods. Mm-hmm. See me never.
I'm going to go be psychic by myself.
Pretty much, right? So, like, I don't know. There's a lot of ongoing allegory and, again, stuff that makes it feel very modern or very current to today, which mm-hmm. I think, and again, this approach, a lot of series, especially ones that, like, end happy, is like, oh, we have you know, the two opposite sides have come to terms with each other, and now we are living this peaceful, you know, lovely world where everyone just coexists together, a la, like, Star Trek and stuff.
It's interesting to see how it shows, like, the different factions of people after this war ends up with really nothing being solved. Like, yes, they break the computer, but, like, they break the computer, but that didn't magically fix everything. You know, the humans and the Muse still don't see eye to eye on anything. So it's in, and the Earth is still, like, fucked. Like, throughout the whole thing, most of humanity doesn't even live on the Earth's surface. And it's sort of, it's, we never see a single day of good weather depicted at all. In fact, things seem to just be getting worse and worse. So even though it doesn't come right out and say it, it does suggest that maybe there's an ice age oncoming, but it's implied to some extent that the Earth has been irreparably damaged. And that even if it's coming back to some extent, like, it's never gonna be the way that it was. Weather patterns are more extreme. There's, you know, rising water levels. When things get cold, they get very, very cold. When things get rainy, it's a hurricane. This isn't, and sort of, like, to that effect, we see not only does shutting down the computer not fix anything, really, but we just see, like, humanity fracturing off into, you know, its own different sects. I think it's interesting that we see, in particular, a group of cultists, I guess, turning to Physis as a goddess. And it's sort of just, like, an offhand, like, it's on one page. And then we move on to see some other corner of humanity. But I thought that was particularly interesting because that is also what Soldier Blue called her, was goddess. Because she has this vision of the Earth as it once was programmed into her, because she, spoilers, is another android, like Keith, embodiment of, like, his hopes and dreams for the Mew and for himself. Which is very objectifying, and I think that's kind of the point. It's interesting to see that cycle continue, and it almost feels like a commentary on religion as a whole, although it's not fleshed out at all. But as this thing that desperate people cling to for hope, right? Even if there's no real basis, you know, the Earth that she has programmed into her is, you know, essentially a photograph taken many, many, many hundreds of years ago. It doesn't exist anymore. Sort of an idol, an icon of something that is never going to exist again.
Well, yeah, it's that, again, the nostalgia for the past. Soldier Blue and Physis as well, to a certain extent, have this I guess, unrealistic expectation for their dream, right? Insofar as, like, Earth, as you said, Earth is not going to ever be this, the way that it was. So they are chasing a dream. They are absolutely dreamers in that sense, that they have this beautiful ideal for a peaceful existence for their people. Jeremy has a more balanced, because he's lived, like, kind of, he didn't have a hard time necessarily in humanity, like, being raised by these computers. He has all of the leadership of the Mew up until Tony has a what's the word they recognize humanity as victims of this computer. They don't hate humanity itself. They hate the fact that the computer makes them, you know, has pushed them out of humanity, and that humanity, quote unquote, normal humans, have been brainwashed up until this point to hate the Mew, and they recognize that that is a function of this giant computer, which is why their goal, aside from, like, let's go to Earth, is to destroy the computer, which is ultimately what they do. Whereas Tony doesn't have that, like, interest or nostalgia whatsoever. He has purely existed in Mew society. He is, oh my god, so powerful, and, you know...
just so exists, psychic. He's so incredibly so psychic.
But he's also, yeah, he's lived a very charmed and protected life within Mew society. Like, he's been special from day one because he is, again, the first, like, live birth of a human slash Mew ever. So it means that he's been just treated like something or someone so incredibly godly. This idea of you're born perfectly and you're definitely going to be, you know, the hope for our peoples, which is why once he becomes the leadership of the Mew, he doesn't have any attachment to Earth. He doesn't, all he has ever seen is humanity and this computer trying to eradicate the Mew, and so it makes more sense as to why he's like, I'm just not even gonna engage with that. We are going out into outer space and see you never, right? Which is why, again, why this series, unlike some sci-fi and a lot of sci-fi of the era, there is no happy conclusion of, like, and then humanity and the aliens coexist peacefully, and we all understand each other. Like, there's, again, Tony doesn't have that. He never, I don't, well, I mean, this is also why you don't make a 10-year-old your leader. but he doesn't, he in a way also just never has his beliefs questioned, again, because he is seen as this godlike infant.
Because he'll literally explode your brain from the inside out if you try.
Yeah, exactly. How dare you question me? I know all, which is a very 10-year-old thing to think. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me that he's just like, well, bye, guys. He's that kid that once, you know, he gets pissed off, he just takes his ball and goes home. He's like,
play elsewhere.
Like, you guns. Yeah, so the series, comparatively, does not have a happy ending, quote-unquote. We do not have a peaceful and harmonious coexistence between groups. So that has been our discussion on the classic sci-fi series, To Terra, Toward Terra, Terrae, by Keiko Takamiya. A series that is certainly a classic in a lot of senses. It's one that, despite its age, does appeal even now and is still relevant in ways that are a little bit scary. So, yeah. But that is all for this month. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We appreciate everyone who sent in questions. It was a little bit of a last-minute switch. We've just had some scheduling issues, and, you know, the year has gone quickly. It sneaks up on all of us. For next month, we are actually looping back, and we are returning to what was meant to be the topic for this week. We are properly launching, soft launching, G's official light novel corner, with a book that is not a light novel at all, but we are going to be talking about Heaven Official's Blessing by MXTX, a Danmei series, very popular Danmei series, being released in English by Seven Seas. This is one of the more notable and popular Danmei series, and one of the first in English. It'll also be the first Danmei that Rei is reading. She has, from my understanding, been somewhat interested in starting, and on recommendation from myself, this is where she's wanting to start, because this story kind of just appeals the most to her. So, if you have any questions, we do have some questions from prior to the episode switch up, but if you have any other questions, be sure to let us know. I will be posting about it on Twitter if it still exists by then. I've been saying that for months, but it could be any day now. Who knows? Additionally, if you have listened to this podcast and enjoyed it, be sure to leave a rating, a review on whatever podcasting platform you're listening to us on, or on YouTube, comments. We really appreciate that. It does actually, it's a little thing, but it means a lot. Because, you know, we don't get a lot of feedback about this podcast necessarily, so it's good to know if people are enjoying it. Rei has had some technical difficulties, so you're left with me for this wrap-up. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Both of us will catch you in the next episode next month, so have a wonderful and safe time until then. Bye for now!